All right, so we are picking up in our study in the Minor Prophets, and we are in the book of Nahum. And I am going to read through Nahum chapter 2 because I'm trying to make that a habit of reading through the passage before we go back and look at it. Nahum chapters 2 and 3 are really quite descriptive. He writes in, he's an action writer, so to say. And you'll see this as we work through this. But let me just read through it, and then we'll come back and hit it verse by verse. So Nahum 2:1. The one who scatters has come up against you. Man the fortress, watch the road, strengthen your back, summon all your strength. For the Lord will restore the splendor of Jacob like the splendor of Israel, even though devastators have devastated them and destroyed their vine branches. The shields of his mighty men are colored red. The warriors are dressed in scarlet. The chariots are enveloped in flashing steel when he is prepared to march, and the cypress spears are brandished. The chariots race madly in the streets. They rush wildly in the squares. Their appearance is like torches. They dash to and fro like lightning flashes. He remembers his nobles. They stumble in their march. They hurry to her wall, and the mantelet is set up. The gates of the rivers are opened, and the palace is dissolved. It is fixed. She is stripped. She is carried away, and her handmaids are moaning like the sound of doves beating on their breasts. Though Nineveh was like a pool of water throughout her days, now they are fleeing. Stop, stop, but no one turns back. Plunder the silver, plunder the gold, for there is no limit to the treasure. Wealth from every kind of desirable object. She is emptied, yes, she is desolate and waste. Hearts are melting and knees knocking. Also anguish is in the whole body, and all their faces are grown pale. Where is the den of the lions and the feeding place of the young lions, where the lion, lioness, and lion's club prowled with nothing to disturb them? The lion tore enough for his cubs, killed enough for his lioness, and filled his lairs with prey and his dens with torn flesh. Behold, I am against you, declares the Lord of hosts. I will burn up her chariots in smoke. A sword will devour your young lions. I will cut off your prey from the land, and no longer will the voice of your messengers be heard. In Nahum chapter 2, remember in the basic outline that I gave that Nahum 1:1 gives you the introduction of the prophet, who he's writing against. Specifically, it's an oracle against Nineveh. And we talked about how in verse 15 of Nahum chapter 1, we know the audience is Judah, because they're mentioned there by name. But the judgment that Nahum declares in Nahum chapter 1, he describes in Nahum chapters 2 and 3. So we have judgment declared and judgment described. And that's what we're reading here. We're reading God's judgment that he is bringing against the Ninevites. And verse 13, where it starts there and it says, "Behold, I am against you, declares the Lord of hosts." You see that same statement again in Nahum 3:5. We'll see it again when we jump into our second part, where God says, "Behold, I am against you, declares the Lord of hosts." Those are words you don't want to hear coming from the mouth of God. And what it tells us, and I'm going to hearken back to last week's study, what it tells us is that God is the primary cause of what is going on here in the city of Nineveh. And when you're reading about the judgment here, and we'll jump into it here in just a second, but when you're reading about this judgment, you're reading about the attack of the Babylonians and Medes who came against Nineveh to destroy it. And so we'll work through this as we go through this. But I want to just keep that primary and secondary cause in our mind as we work through this passage. So let's work through it a little more carefully. By the way, another thing is just, as I read through these verses, I could not help but think of 1 Peter 5:5. in which Peter quotes from the Old Testament, from Proverbs, but he says, God is opposed to the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. And you will find that all throughout Scripture, that whenever you see God's dealings with people, you either see him as opposing the proud or giving grace to the humble. And so when you read this about this account, and of course we've talked a little bit about the Ninevites and how atrocious they were, just how vicious they were in their attacks and their brutalities. It's unimaginable what they did. But you can understand when the Lord is coming against them that he is opposing this proud people, this proud nation. So going back to Nahum chapter 2, verse 1, the one who scatters has come up against you. Now, the one who scatters here in this verse is a reference to the Babylonians and to the Medes. The leader of the Medes was a king by the name of Cyaxares. Cyaxares, yeah, it's kind of hard to pronounce some of these names. The leader for the Babylonians was a man by the name of Nabopolassar. Now, I've mentioned Nabopolassar before. Do you remember who Nabopolassar was? He was the father of Nebuchadnezzar. And so, the text doesn't give us that, but we know who it is from history. And so you have this Babylonian-Median alliance, this military alliance that is coming up against the Ninevites, who were the Assyrians. Nineveh was the capital of Assyria. And so Cyaxares and Nabopolassar are the commanders leading this. So the one who scatters has come up against you. And then he tells them, man the fortress, watch the road, strengthen your back, summon all your strength. And what Nahum is doing here is he is sarcastically calling for the Assyrians to defend themselves. Basically, rush and man the fortress, watch the road, strengthen your back, summon all your strength. In other words, pull yourself together and prepare yourself for battle. Now, it's not going to help. It's not going to do any good. Because for these people with nothing more than their human energy to rise up against God, it's futile. And so what we have there is that picture of destruction that is going to come upon them. And in verse 2 it says, for the Lord will restore the splendor of Jacob, like the splendor of Israel. Now, this is going to be an encouraging word. Remember that his primary audience is going to be to Judah, to the Judahites. And the Judahites have been under the oppressive rule of the Ninevites for roughly about a century now, since the days of Jonah, since that generation after Jonah's. Because remember, Jonah's generation repented and turned to the Lord. They believed in the Lord and they turned from their wickedness. But subsequent generations did not. They went right back into that behavior. And either the parents failed to communicate the things that they had learned to subsequent generations, or the subsequent generations heard it and rejected it. And it just goes to show that that the godliness of one generation is just the godliness of one generation. And each generation that comes up must make that choice to perpetuate the values of their parents. And if the values are rooted in the Word of God, well, then good. If not, well, then what's going to come? You know, is it just a matter of time before the nation begins to decline as a whole? But God here is talking to the Judahites, to Israel, to his people. And this would have been a word of encouragement to them, that the Lord will restore the splendor of Jacob like the splendor of Israel. Even though the devastators, and that would be the Assyrians, have devastated them and destroyed their vine branches. So in contrast to the Assyrian destruction, God promises restoration to his people. Now, part of that is just simply by removing the harm, by removing the Ninevites, by removing this tyranny, this tyrannical oppression, which was over his people and destroying his people. That's going to allow them to have the time to gather together again in peaceful times. And I think back to that statement in Nahum 1:15 where he says, behold, on the mountains the feet of him who brings good news, who announces peace, And again, what was that good news? Well, the good news is that the enemy was destroyed. You no longer have to deal with this tyranny. It would be comparable, and I think of the Ninevites, I try to think of the closest approximate comparison. And, you know, when I think about how cruel they are, I think of ISIS and their cruelties. Because they will decapitate people. They will burn people alive. They will crucify people. Their tactics are just absolutely brutal. Now, I don't even think ISIS compares to the Ninevites. I think the Ninevites were pretty bad. I think, I'm not sure that they've been, that anybody has done what they've done historically. But if you have a people living in the Middle East who are suffering under the oppression of ISIS, and then all of a sudden ISIS is wiped out, yay, right? The tyranny is removed. And I think that's the idea here, that when you read that, behold on the mountains the feet of him who brings good news, who announces peace, that would be with regard to the destruction of the Assyrians. Yes, ma'am?
Is this one of those things like, it hasn't happened yet, but it will?
Proleptic?
Proleptic.
Yes, and there is a statement in here in which I will deal with that. And it is. And the proleptic statement is a statement that views a future event with such certainty that it speaks of it as though it has already come to pass.
Haven't been destroyed yet, but it is so certain.
It is so certain that it's viewed as already come to pass. It's like when people make the statement, you can take that to the bank. Because it's so certain it's there, you just have to go and claim it. And it's just a matter of time before this will come to pass. But this is where it becomes a prophetic certainty, that this is what the Lord is declaring will in fact happen. And so, yes, it is a proleptic statement. That would be correct. But then notice what he goes on to say in verse 15. He says, celebrate your feasts, O Judah, pay your vows, for never again will the wicked one pass through you. He is completely cut off. Because they hadn't even had time to celebrate their feasts or pay their vows to the Lord. And so this allows them to be able to resume those religious holidays that were part of the fabric of the Mosaic Law. But again, it speaks of a time when they can resume some festivities. Because again, the tyranny, the oppression is removed. And that's the same thing we see here in Nahum 2:2, where God is again promising them that he will restore them, that he will restore the splendor of Jacob, like the splendor of Israel, even though devastators have devastated them and destroyed their vine branches. So in contrast to the destruction that God, will bring upon the Assyrians, he also promises restoration to his people. And this is going to encourage them. This is going to give them hope. And it's just like us. I mean, we live in the same reality. There are certain hopes. I mean, Nancy was in there in the kitchen earlier, and we were talking about, looking forward to the Lord's coming back, right? Because then we're not going to have to deal with any of these bodily ailments. I mean, the older I get, I mean, I turned 52 this year, and my body's creaking and groaning and aching. And of course, they say it's not the years, but the mileage. I feel like I have a lot of mileage on this body. But I feel like there's also the trade-off, too, because with age comes wisdom, with age comes maturity, with age comes certain things that are lost. I have a friend of mine down in Austin, and he's 50, and I called him the other day while I was driving to work, and I hope he's not listening to this message, but he just had a son. And his concern is, gee, here I am, 50, just got a brand new baby, okay? And so he's thinking ahead. He's thinking, gee, by the time I'm, approaching 70, he's just going to be, maybe going into college or in the military or something, but he's thinking, what kind of father can I be? And I told him, and we've been friends now for 29 years because we met at the Lubbock County Jail. And he used to come to my Bible classes way back when, and here he is, but he's part owner in a company, and anyway, he's doing very well. I'm very impressed with him. But I told him, I encouraged him. I said, look, man, I said, physically you may not have the stamina. I said, but you have the years of wisdom and maturity that you can impart to him the life skills that will prove much more beneficial to him when he gets older in life. because you have wisdom and you have skills and you have maturity, things that you can share with him that comes to you because of your age. So you capitalize on what you have, not what you don't have. And what he has to offer to his children is of infinitely greater worth than anything that he may lack with regard to physical activity. And so anyway, I tried to encourage him. But it is one of those things, I think, where with wisdom, with years, comes that. Why did I go into that? Why was I not commenting on that? Okay, anyway, thank you. You received it, right? You heard it, okay. I do that too. I hear stuff and I just think, well, what was he going with that? Okay, but thank you. It spoke to me. So it was hope. It was hope. It was this thing where you're looking for a future hope. And so we know that the Lord is coming back. We know that this is not all there is to life. What's the saying? You know, if there is no God and there is no future hope, then this is as good as it gets. But knowing there is God and knowing that Christ is coming back, this is as worst as it gets. Mm-hmm. You know, and yet we have that hope. We know he's coming and we anticipate that. And we're not sure when, but we're looking forward to it. And we're looking forward to all the benefits and blessings that come with that. So we live in that same hope. And it encourages us. It strengthens us to go on about the day. So going on into verse 3. Now this is going to be a description of the Babylonian and Median troops that are going to come in to attack. So in verse 3, he says, the shields of his mighty men are colored red, and his mighty men would be the Babylonian and Median armies. Because these are the ones that are coming into the city. And they're coming into the city to attack and to destroy. And the language that Nahum employs here, the way he describes these warriors as they come in, their shields, the color of their clothing, their spears, the flashing of their chariots. It's very vivid. And so he says, the shields of his mighty men are colored red. The warriors are dressed in scarlet. And it could be that these red shields and uniforms could be a form of psychological warfare. He goes on to describe them. Notice what he says, the chariots are enveloped in flashing steel when he is prepared to march, and the cypress spears are brandished. The chariots race madly in the streets. They rush wildly in the squares. Their appearance is like torches. They dash to and fro like lightning flashes. Again, very descriptive language. And when it talks about them in the squares and in the streets, I take this to be in the suburbs just outside the city walls. So not within the city walls proper, but within the suburbs just outside the city walls. So as the army comes to approach, those who are up on the walls are looking down and they're watching these soldiers dressed in red with their red shields and their flashing chariots, and they're racing through the streets with their spears and their swords, and it's very quick and they're striking down all these people. And visually, if you're up on the wall and you're looking down at this invading army coming in, I mean that's going to play in your mind. I mean psychologically, it's going to have an impact. But I think that's the picture here is of this invading army just outside the city walls. Now in verse 5, it shifts over from talking about the Medo-Babylonian attack to that of the king of Assyria. So in Nahum 1:5, it says, he, and this would be the Assyrian king, remembers his nobles. And notice what it says. They stumble in their march. They hurry to her wall, that is, to the main wall of the city. And by the way, it's this statement here that makes me think that the soldiers are fighting outside the city walls, at least in these first couple verses. Because here he's calling his nobles to hurry to the wall. Well, that's the wall of the city. And so they hurry to the wall, in other words, to support it, and the mantelet is set up. The mantelet was a movable shelter. It was something that a few men could carry and put into place, but it was like a movable shelter that men could go into and could use along the city walls as a means of protection against arrows. And then he goes on in verse 6, the gates of the rivers are opened and the palace is dissolved. Now that statement is questionable, and I scratched my head over it. I read it and read it and read it and looked at different translations, and I really kind of scratched my head at it. The thing that I think I take away from it is that when it says the gates of the rivers are opened and the palace is dissolved, it's the idea that basically that there was a flood prior to the invasion that destroyed part of the city wall, the structure, and flooded into the city and flooded the palace itself. Now, there are some historical records that talk about floods that occurred prior to the invasion that could have weakened the walls and the fortifications and maybe even some of the buildings inside the city. If that's the case, then in effect God would be using natural disaster as a means to weaken the city before he sends the Babylonians and Medes in to deliver the final blows. So it would definitely add to that that understanding. Verse number 7, it is fixed. Now that statement really jumped off the page at me, because it's the idea that it's fixed in God's decree, that God has determined this will come to pass. And so this is certain. And again, imagine you're an Israelite. Imagine you're a Judahite. Imagine you're the one hearing this message from the prophet Nahum. And you're getting this description, these prophetic, these proleptic statements about this future destruction of these people that have been tyrannizing you. And you realize that from the divine perspective that these events are fixed in the mind of God, that these are so certain to come to pass, that he says that it is fixed. And notice what is fixed, that she, Assyria, is stripped. She is carried away, and her handmaids are moaning like the sound of doves beating their breasts. And it's the picture of defeat and the whimper that comes from defeat. And again, you have to put yourself back into the mind of the Judahite who was alive at this time in history and who was hearing these things and was knowing that God, their God, was the one who was rising up against their enemy to defeat them, and that these things are certain, that they will come to pass, that this is fixed in the mind and in the will of God. Verse number 8, he says, though Nineveh was like a pool of water throughout her days, now they are fleeing. Well, that is the leadership and the people and everybody are just fleeing. And so the king and his nobles are crying out, stop, stop. In other words, don't flee, don't run away from the battle. But notice what he says, but no one turns back. In other words, they're not listening to the leadership, they're fleeing for their lives. The NIV captures this, I think, well in their translation. He says, Nineveh is like a pool whose water is draining away. Stop, stop, they cry, but no one turns back. So just as the water drains away from a pool, so the people are draining away from the city. They're fleeing away is the picture here. And then once the city is defeated, then there is the call in verse 9, plunder the silver, plunder the gold. In other words, take the wealth of Assyria for yourself. And the Assyrians had accumulated mass amounts of wealth. They had defeated so many people and had taken away their wealth and stored it. And so you have, once now that they're defeated, naturally you're going to come in and you're going to take their wealth. And so that's the call. Plunder the silver, plunder the gold, for there is no limit to the treasure, wealth from every kind of desirable object. Verse 10, she is emptied. In other words, it pictures the city is emptied of its people. It's emptied of its treasures. Yes, she is desolate and waste. And as we've talked about a few moments ago, this is another proleptic statement of Assyria's fall. Because at this time, again, the event has not yet occurred. This is prophetic. But again, the event is viewed with such certainty that it can be spoken of in the present tense as having already come to pass, because it is that certain to occur. So going back to verse 10, she is emptied. Yes, she is desolate and waste. Hearts are melting and knees knocking. Also, anguish is in the whole body, and all their faces are grown pale. And this would be because of the devastation. So now they're getting a taste of what they inflicted upon others. They are now experiencing what they have inflicted upon others to experience. Going on in verse 11, where is the den of lions in the feeding place of the young lions, where the lion, lioness, and lion's cub prowled with nothing to disturb them? In other words, the lion's den, Nineveh, is now empty. So it's asking the question, where are the lions, the young lions, the lioness, where there was nobody to disturb them? Well, they've been disturbed. They've been destroyed. Verse 12, the lion tore enough for his cubs, killed enough for his lionesses, and filled his lairs with prey and his dens with torn flesh. Again, speaking of the behavior that the Ninevites held to. And then you have that statement in verse 13 that we talked about early on, where God says, behold, I am against you. Now that, again, that's not something you want to hear coming from the mouth of God. And it's not something you want to hear. Because what it results in is their destruction. And he goes on to say, I will burn up her chariots in smoke. And the chariots here represented the height of military machinery. So when he says, I will burn up her chariots in smoke, it's the idea of destroying Assyria's military machinery. A sword will devour your young lions. That is, the invading army will destroy the Assyrian soldiers. He says, I will cut off your prey from the land. And notice the back and forth there. He's going to burn up the chariots with smoke, in smoke. A sword, and that is through the secondary cause of the Medes and the Babylonians. But then he goes back to first person, I will cut off your prey from the land. And so they will not be able to attack the defenseless anymore. And no longer will the voice of your messengers be heard. The messengers were the ones, and we looked at that in the introduction, that Kings and Isaiah talk about this man named Rabshakeh, who was one of the Assyrian men who went forth, a voice, a messenger who went out and who would, in his own way, engage in psychological warfare, promising peace to anybody who surrendered. In fact, there's a passage over in Isaiah 35. I think it's 35. It's Isaiah 36, verses 16 and 17. We read about it in 2 Kings, but this is the account as it appears in the book of Isaiah. In Isaiah 36, verses 16 and 17, you remember that when Assyria came against Jerusalem, let me go back up. And remember, this guy, he used language as a means of psychological warfare. And you go back to Isaiah 36, verse 12, for example. But Rabshakeh said, has my master sent me only to your master and to you to speak these words, and not to the men who sit on the wall, doomed to eat their own dung and drink their own urine with you? And that's the idea of if you resist me, That's what you're going to be doing. Okay? And then Rabshakeh stood and cried with a loud voice in Judean and said, hear the words of the great king, the king of Assyria. Thus says the king, do not let Hezekiah deceive you, for he is not able to deliver you. But then notice what he says, in verse 15, nor let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord. That was his big mouth, big mistake. Nor let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord, saying, the Lord will surely deliver us. This city shall not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. But notice what he says in verse 16 and 17, and this is that Rabshakeh, that messenger of Assyria. Do not listen to Hezekiah, for thus says the king of Assyria, make your peace with me. In other words, don't listen, stop listening to Hezekiah. and Isaiah the prophet, and anybody else that you're listening to, make your peace with me. And notice what he says, and come out to me. I mean, you can almost imagine he uses a nice, softer tone, and he says, and eat each of you his vine, and each of his fig tree, and drink each of the waters of his own cistern. Well, doesn't that just sound lovely? You're just going to get to eat the fruit of your crops. And then he says, verse 17, until I come and take you away to a land, well, like your own land. You see, I'm going to take you away to a beautiful place. It's just I'm going to take you somewhere else, but it's just like your own land. A land of grain and new wine, a land of bread and vineyards. See, what he's doing is he says, look, if you defy me, well, then you're going to be eating your dung and drinking your urine and whatever else goes along with whatever cruelties we can inflict upon you. But if you make your peace with me, well, we'll do this peaceful little gentle march and I'll bring you back to my land and it'll all be, we'll just relocate you to a nice, beautiful place. It'll be nice. It'll be a land like your land. No problems. And some people bought that. Some people bought into that language. And out of fear of being attacked and being promised something sweet and lovely, you just have to relocate, they went with it. Until they found themselves in Assyria and betrayed and enslaved and mistreated and murdered. And it was just a psychological trap to lead them in. Yes, it is what the Antichrist will do. That language is very deceitful language. And we know that currently Satan deceives the whole world. That sort of language comes into play. But this is its own form of psychological warfare that's going on here. But when he makes that last comment there in verse 13, where he says, and no longer will the voice of your messengers be heard. Those who come demanding submission, but then also offering promises of peace. But ultimately, it's a lie. And so basically, these are not going to be going out anymore, these messengers. So let's take up the summary, and then we'll take up some Q&A if we have any. The central idea of the text is that God brings an invading army against Nineveh to destroy it. And that's important that we understand it that way, that it is God who brings an invading army against Nineveh to destroy it. Nahum opens his prophecy with a sarcastic call to the Ninevites to defend themselves, saying, man the fortress, watch the road, strengthen your back, summon all your strength. The effort, of course, is futile, for the primary attacker is God himself, against whom no one can stand. Part of the reason for the attack against Nineveh is God's intention to restore the splendor of Jacob like the splendor of Israel. Though Judah had been devastated by the Assyrians, God would destroy them and put an end to their aggression. Nahum describes the battle, saying, the shields of his mighty men are colored red. The warriors are dressed in scarlet. The chariots are enveloped in flashing steel. When he is prepared to march and the cypress spears are brandished. Blood-red shields and uniforms were used by the Babylonians as a means of psychological warfare to strike fear in the enemy. Then the battle erupts. As the chariots race madly in the streets, they rush wildly in the squares, their appearance is like torches, they dash to and fro like lightning flashes. The Assyrians stumble to meet the enemy as they hurry to defend the walls of the city and set up their defenses. Nahum then declares the gates of the rivers are opened and the palace is dissolved. And as I mentioned earlier, there is historical evidence that just before Nineveh's destruction, the city had experienced a series of rainfalls that had caused the Kosar River to swell and damage the city walls, creating an opening for the Babylonians and Medes to enter through. If correct, this would show how God used inclement weather to damage the city's walls in preparation for the Babylonians and Medes, thus ensuring their military success. The events of Nineveh's destruction are fixed according to God's sovereign will, as the city is stripped and carried away into battle, and the Assyrian handmaids are left moaning the destruction. The city is likened to a pool of water that drains away and no one turns back. And though the leader shouts, stop, stop, the attackers are called to plunder the city. No one turns back, in effect. The attackers are called to plunder the city of its great wealth as the residents melt in fear. The great plunderers would be plundered, is the idea. Assyria is described as a ravenous lion and Nineveh as its lair, and both the people and their city are destroyed. God then states unequivocally to the Assyrians, "Behold, I am against you." And though the Lord used the Babylonians and Medes under the leadership of Nebuchadnezzar and Cyaxares, it was ultimately God who brought about their destruction, saying, "I will burn up her chariots in smoke. A sword will devour your young lions. I will cut off your prey from the land, and no longer will the voice of your messengers be heard." God is patient. We've talked about that before. He is patient and waited over 100 years for the Assyrians to repent, but they refused. But God is also a judge. And as judge, God finally rendered a decision against Nineveh, and because of their arrogance and sin, he brought about their destruction. And what we've read at this point up in Nahum chapter 2 is half of the picture, because it's going to continue on in the next hour as we read more of the description of the defeat of the Assyrians by the will of God. Do we feel like we understand the passage a little bit better going through it? Questions?
Yes.
Yes, ma'am, to the lady in the front row.
I have to wrap my mind around this because there's three different people that we're talking about. We've got Judah,
mm-hmm.
we have Assyria,
mm-hmm.
and we have Babylonians and the Medes.
Yes.
Okay.
That's
so
right.
We have the Babylonians and the Medes are coming to destroy Nineveh.
That's right.
We're talking to Judah.
Mm-hmm.
So do we have Judahites living in Nineveh?
Probably not. There may be some that have gone into captivity. But when the Ninevites came up against Jerusalem with their messenger, Rabshakeh,
mm-hmm.
God sent an angel and destroyed the 185,000 Assyrian army,
okay.
and sent the what remaining few was left back home whimpering because they came up against the Lord. So Judah, but remember that Nineveh had come down and had attacked Judah in 701 BC. And they had destroyed 46 cities in the region of Judah. And Judah is in the south. Israel in the north fell in 722 BC. But they came down in 701 BC and attacked and destroyed 46 cities. And then they besieged Jerusalem. And we read about that in 2 Kings, where Hezekiah comes and he prays to the Lord. And the Lord hears him. And the Lord delivers them because of the humility of the leadership and the godliness of the leadership. Hezekiah did it right. He did it right. And God spared the city. Not because of Judah's military might. Assyria, from humanistic perspective, Assyria was the bigger army.
Mm-hmm.
They were the more seasoned army. They were certainly the crueler army. And if God had not intervened, I'm sure that if left to themselves, they would have fallen. But I don't think that there are any Israelites in captivity at this time in Nineveh. If there were, it's probably just here and there, maybe just a few. But I think that when you start off here, it's God promising that Nineveh will be destroyed, the Babylonians and Medes would be the vehicle, the instrument that he would use to bring that about. But the message is to Judah,
mm-hmm.
that God is going to destroy them. They will have their freedom back. They will be able to celebrate their feasts. And their splendor is going to be restored, that God is personally going to restore their splendor. And part of that is destroying the Ninevites to make that happen.
So the plunder and the treasures, who's getting that? The Babylonians and the Medes?
The Babylonians and Medes. Yep, they're taking it.
Right now, Judah is just the observer.
Yeah, Judah's just the observer
okay.
in all this. That's a good point. Thank you, Sherry.
Thank you, Sherry.
Said the spiritual voice from the distant room.
She's listening.
Yeah, she's always listening. But she's right. Judah at this point is just the observer. And they're seeing it through the eyes of Nahum, who is coming to them with divine viewpoint,
okay.
who is coming to them and giving the prophetic announcement to Judah concerning the fall of Nineveh, that God is going to affect this, that he's going to make it happen, that the Medes and the Babylonians are the instrument that he's going to bring that about. And it's pulling together the divine perspective and showing that God is the primary cause behind all of this coming about. But yes, Judah is the observers. They're getting this through the message of Nahum. And it would be encouraging. I mean, my goodness. You know, that this is going to be cause for celebration. And they are, you know, that the splendor of Judah is going to be restored. And God himself is going to make it happen. And just as it is certain that the Ninevites will be destroyed, because that is fixed in God's mind and in God's will, so the restoration of the splendor of Judah is also fixed. That is something that God will bring to pass. God doesn't lie. He can't lie. It's impossible for God to lie. And God has integrity, right? And so this would have been very encouraging words to the Judahites living at this time in history under these conditions.
Yeah, I think there's no TV, there's no internet for everybody to be knowing what's going on at this particular time. You know, there's this one person, you know, as a messenger, you know, getting this message out, which is, you know, we think of it easy to conceive because we got TV, but back then, I mean, it was just him showing up and saying something.
Yes, and for Nahum to go and to put this into written form, it could have been copied and copied and copied and passed around. Again, you know, we're not given the details of how it was communicated, except we know we have it in written form. And this was the message that he delivered to them. And one would take that it was a verbal message, but also that it was a written message. Yes, Nancy?
Well, then it comes to pass 100 years later.
No, the 100 years that I was referring to was the difference between the days of Jonah and the days of Nahum.
Okay.
Because God was very patient, and he had waited over 100 years. Because remember that Nahum's predecessor, Jonah, who preached more than 100 years earlier, that he went to Jonah with a message of repent. And if there's a message of repent, that means, well, it was a message that 40 days in Nineveh is going to be destroyed. And, of course, their thought was, well, gee, if he's warning us that destruction's coming, maybe that's our cue to repent and turn from our wickedness. And they knew they were wicked. I mean, they knew. Yes. And so we have at least the generation of Jonah that repented, turned from their wickedness, and God backed off. He relented and said, I'm not going to destroy you now. You've been spared because God is patient. God is merciful. Thank God, right? He is with me. He is with others. Huh?
Not wanting anyone to perish.
Not wanting anyone to perish. Absolutely.
He gave them a choice, and they chose correctly. But, you know, it goes back to, like, you know, why didn't he just wipe them out? Because he knew that they were going to return to their evil ways.
He did. He absolutely knew that they were. But he gave them options, you see, and he gave them time. And time is a display of grace, is what it is. And it's time to think about what you're doing, time to be aware, time to turn from your wickedness. Anyway, any other questions about Nahum here? We good? Let's take a break.